Welcome to episode 118 of TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host and THR's excellent chief TV critic, Dan Feinberg. Dan, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing okay. As we are recording this, it is NFL Draft Eve, so happy NFL Draft to those who celebrate.
That would not be me. I'm just excited that the Dodgers snapped the losing streak, which feels unfamiliar for me. So
it happens. But anyway, yes, the Dodgers definitely had a couple ugly games in a row. I'm sure our listeners are downright miserable, but happy they're off the schneid.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's dive into this week's headlines. What do you say? It's been a busy one. Leading off, move over, Seth MacFarlane. Nearly 10 years after Fox passed on the Family Guy creator's animated series, it's Elizabeth Banks instead who is now updating The Flintstones. Banks will voice the role of the now 20-something Pebbles and exec produce an animated sequel series called Bedrock for the broadcast network.
A Netflix star is back in business with the streamer as Noah Centineo will star in a CIA drama series from The Rookie showrunner and friend of the five, Alexi Hawley. In other streaming pickups, Josh Gad and Isla Fisher will star in Wolf Like Me, a straight-to-series romantic comedy for Peacock. And in late-breaking news as we're recording this, Amazon has renewed the animated series Invincible for a second and third season because, as Leslie likes to say,
animated shows take more time to produce. Returning to Fox, the network has added another series to its schedule for next season with the Unreal-like show within a show, The Big Leap, starring Scott Foley. Elsewhere on broadcast, and file this under S for shocker, ABC has passed on its straight-to-series comedy starring Alec Baldwin and Kelsey Grammer from Modern Family creator Chris Lloyd. Dan, who could have seen that coming?
Definitely dealing with people who have no egos and personalities and who everyone would be happy to work with for 300 episodes in perpetuity.
And no problematic backgrounds whatsoever or rival shows for another streaming service. So there you go. Over at CBS, the network has formally greenlit NCIS Hawaii and renewed veteran NCIS Los Angeles, which will keep the franchise at three series next season after NCIS New Orleans wraps in May.
In showrunner news, Marvel has enlisted poet, educator, and Snowpiercer scribe, and those are not three things that go together all that frequently, Shanaka Hodge to serve as head writer for its Disney Plus series Ironheart, starring Dominique Thorne. Queen of the South alum Natalie Chaidez has signed on as co-showrunner on The Flight Attendant for its second season on HBO Max. At HBO proper, Perry Mason duo and TV's top five guests, Ron Fitzgerald and Roland Jones, have departed ahead of season two, with the Nick creators, Michael Bagler and Jack Amiel, taking over as part of a rich overall deal with the premium cable giant.
And THR's resident Bachelor Nation expert and fellow friend of the five, Jackie Strauss, reports that Rachel Lindsay has parted ways with the beleaguered ABC franchise after exiting her Bachelor Happy Hour podcast.
And finally, in casting news, Grand Hotel alum Rosalind Sanchez will star as a descendant of Mr. Rourke in Fox's Fantasy Island update, which will premiere in August on the network.
Well, with all that out of the way, let's dive into this week's top five.
Number one.
Leading off this week, the days are getting longer and it's sunny and beautiful in LA. Summer is around the corner and May's TV offerings are heating up. See what I did there, Dan?
Kind of.
Well, May brings a lot of new high-profile streaming and premium cable shows. You've got a lot of final seasons beginning and some ending. And then, of course, May also means a lot of the broadcast shows are wrapping their seasons. So running down some of the big anticipated things that coming in May, you've got the final seasons of Pose, Shrill, Special, The Kominsky Method, and The Bold Type on FX, Hulu, Netflix, and Freeform, respectively. Then you've got Mom and NCIS New Orleans signing off on CBS. On premium cable, Z-Way arrives on Showtime. In Treatment returns with a new take on HBO. The Girlfriend Experience is back for another cycle on Stars, which also gets into the female friendship comedy space with Run the World. Over on Netflix, you've got Mark Millar's first Netflix show, Jupiter's Legacy. Part two of Selena the Series arrives, and Master of None is back with its Denise-focused third season. Over at Disney Plus, you've got the animated Clone Wars spinoff, Star Wars The Bad Batch. Peacock gets into the girl group business with Girls 5 Eva. Mythic Quest is back on Apple. And then Gene Smart's comedy Hacks arrive on HBO Max. And then Last but certainly not least, Amazon's long in the works, the Underground Railroad, finally pulls into the station. Dan, lots of stuff coming. It feels like a really good month for high-quality TV.
It's a busy month. We talked, you know, back 100 years ago when it was last May about how there was a shift towards networks and streamers basically doing for the Emmys what movie studios have done with Oscars for many, many years, which was basically saving all of their big Oscar contenders for the fall festival season and for release in January and for release in November and December, basically at the last minute before awards contention. And since the Emmy window runs until May 31st, you're definitely seeing a number of shows that are trying to get in, you know, for what is, as we've also discussed, a very, very strange year for Emmys, particularly on the comedy side, where a lot of things are suddenly now thinking that they can sneak into a very, very thin field. So something like Kaminsky Method, which has been a nominee in the past, something like Master of None, which has been a nominee in the past. Those are things that are like, okay, well, this is a field that we really should be able to find room in. And then you get a couple of new things that are feeling like they could sneak in. So Girls 5 Eva has definite 30 Rock type energy. And so 30 Rock was an Emmy favorite. Maybe that's a player. Hacks has Gene Smart. So, you know, if you should be able to get a Gene Smart comedy, a Gene Smart Emmy nomination, that should be the way it works because she's freaking Gene Smart. And so there's a lot of that happening. And then even the fields that are already absurdly full are getting fuller. The Underground Railroad has to be a contender in the limited series category. But if you go and look at the limited series Emmy possibilities, who knows? Who knows what they're bumping out? Who knows what is set in stone? Because that is the prestige category this year at the Emmys. You're looking at a bunch of weird stuff getting nominated, probably on the comedy fields. You're looking at some weird stuff getting in on the drama side. I don't think it's going to be as aggressively and relentlessly weird as the comedy fields. There will be some stuff on the comedy side that gets nominated that is just ridiculous. There will be some embarrassing nominations on the comedy side simply because of the strangeness of the year and because voters are, I don't know, are unlikely to look at the things that really deserve true contention. So something like, to me, I'll even say it by its actual name in non-joke format here because I want to use it as an example. Hulu's Pen 15 needs to be at the top of people's Emmy list. There is no world in which Anna Conkle and Maya Erskine should not be nominated for Emmys this year. And the fact that the only place I'm seeing them on various pundits' early lists are as contenders or possibilities, that is ridiculous. They should both be at the top of everybody's list in terms of pure quality. So if people don't find a way to get things like that, or to get Aaliyah Shawkat for the new season of Search Party, which is the best work she's done on that show ever. Yeah, there is some good stuff that they could nominate on the comedy side. I just don't think they're going to. So yeah, looking at the stuff that is premiering in May, it is primarily stuff that is contenders for last minute slots for awards. I think Apple TV probably thinks that Mythic Quest could sneak in after, you know, a second season and after a lot of really, really good buzz for the quarantine episode and all of that. That's a show that definitely has gained momentum. You're not seeing that many blockbuster shows, and so that's where something like a Jupiter's Legacy kind of stands out, and maybe it's kind of a differentiating factor that if you don't have a new Marvel show on Disney Plus this month, because you have to wait all the way until June to get to Loki. God, what are we going to do for a month without a Marvel show to watch on Friday mornings? So yeah, something like a Jupiter's Legacy could find a way to basically find a playing field empty. Star Wars, The Bad Batch is the kind of thing that under normal circumstances, animation heads and Star Wars heads would be totally into, and it would be great. But in a world without a new Marvel show and in a world without The Mandalorian, is that going to find a wider crossover audience? Because at this moment, basically what Disney Plus has otherwise is it's two strangely parallel underdog sports shows with Mighty Ducks and with Big Shot. So There's a lot of stuff this month. A lot of it is very interesting. A lot of great showrunners for us to talk to. And so that's always fun and exciting. We've definitely had months. Who we got lined up on the horizon, Leslie?
Well, we've got Yvette Lee Bowser for Run the World on Stars. Alan Yang will be popping in to talk Master of None. Next week, we'll have Meredith Scardino to talk about Girls 5 Eva. Yeah, we got some good ones lined up.
And we didn't even, I didn't even mention when I was listing the various things that are premiering, new season of In Treatment, which is another show that absolutely is an Emmy contender. And we're hoping to have folks from that one with us. So there are good people making hopefully good TV this month. And hopefully we have moved significantly enough past those February and March weeks when there was literally nothing on TV.
Yeah, and then you still have new episodes of The Handmaid's Tale and the final season of Pose, and we keep talking about Pose, and we'll have much more about Pose in this week's Showrunner Spotlight interview, which is a fantastic conversation with co-creator Stephen Canals.
It becomes very temporally confusing, Leslie, when you tell people that it's coming up, but we already know it's a good conversation. How do we know it? We haven't recorded it yet, Leslie. We've totally recorded it, y'all.
Yeah. Well, that takes us to our next topic this week.
Number two.
Up second, the second of Marvel's Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, signed off recently to a little bit of a different response than its predecessor, WandaVision. Joining us to break it all down is THR's Heat Vision editor and friend of the five, Aaron Couch. Thanks for stopping by, Aaron.
Thank you.
So I'll be honest, I stopped watching after, I think, two episodes. It felt a little bit too Marvel mythology heavy for me. But from your vantage point, how was this finale and this season received when you're comparing it to WandaVision?
Well, the Captain America stuff is my favorite stuff that Marvel does. So I like this considerably more than WandaVision, as much as I liked WandaVision. However, I do think that the consensus is the overall quality of WandaVision was more consistent and just more there, where I think that many people felt there were elements of Falcon and the Winter Soldier that weren't as strong as the other elements. You know, I think that some of the stuff with the terror organization, people are kind of scratching their heads at. But the pros of this show were so strong for me that it ended up being one of my more, one of the things I liked most that Walt Marvel's done in the last few years.
Well, definitely they were selling it. And you can go back to our interview with Malcolm Spellman from episode 113, heavily around the buddy comedy aspect to it. And for the most part, that wasn't really what the show was. And yet those were a lot of the moments that were most enjoyable. Did you feel like that was sort of a thing that people were kind of going back and forth on? Like, where is the buddy comedy we were promised?
Yeah, I think that when you have Anthony Mackie and Sebastian Stan, you expected more of that charm and charisma between them. Episode 5, which was many people felt was the best, but a lot of people kind of made fun of it. I thought it was the best one, but other people were saying it's just guys making, you know, fixing a boat. But I thought that had a lot of the charm. You know, Bucky's kind of seems to have some sort of flirtation with Sam's sister. You know, there's a lot of cute stuff, the nephews. So yeah.
No, I'm there with you. I found that I was liking a lot of the nitty gritty stuff more because I loved the bank loan scene in the first episode, and I am disappointed we did not get a return update to the mortgage and loan information from the premiere. So, but I may be in the minority on that one.
I love that stuff too. Yeah, exactly.
So with Marvel, so much of these series, the conversation around them is how they connect to the larger MCU. So without having seen the ending of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, does it connect directly into the next Marvel thing out, which is, I guess, Loki in June? And then I think you've got Black Widow in theaters, right?
Yeah, exactly. Black Widow in July. No, there's no direct connection that we know of. It certainly sets up, you know, Sam Wilson as Captain America. It sets up a few other potential villains, but we don't know when we'll see any of these characters again. You know, I don't expect to see them in Loki, and you know, Black Widow, at least most of it, if not all of it, is a prequel. So yeah, I don't think it really ties in to the immediate next few months, at least, and maybe even not the next year.
But then it does tie in because they just announced Captain America 4, right?
Yes. Yes.
And so it's from Malcolm Spellman, the same head writer of Falcon, right?
Yeah, Anthony Mackie apparently did not know this movie was in the works. And I do actually, you know, that's what they usually say, but I do believe him. He said in an interview, he was told on Friday after THR broke the story, the guy at his local grocery store was like, congrats on the movie. And then showed him the you know, a story about it. So obviously, I mean, Malcolm Spellman is co-writing this with a staff writer from the show. They have to write the movie. They have to develop it, get Mackie, you know, we don't know if Mackie has a deal or not for the movie. So they're still a few years out from I think, Anthony Mackie's Captain America 4, for sure.
Well, do we know that Captain America 4 is going to be the Anthony Mackie Captain America 4? What do we know so far about what they're trying to do with that?
Yeah, it's presumed to be Mackie, but because we don't know if there's a deal, it's one of those things where you can't say, Anthony Mackie starring in this movie, because, you know, they got to negotiate and all sorts of things. And after, you know, obviously we don't know the ratings, but, you know, it's been doing pretty well in Rick Porter's excellent Nielsen charts. So, I mean, hey, if this thing is as popular as it seems to be, that seems like a good negotiating table to be at for Anthony Mackie's team. So, yeah, we you know, it's entirely possible that Chris Evans could even come back and have some sort of role in this, which we don't know. I mean, he retired in Avengers Endgame, but there's been, you know, rumors for months that, hey, he might come back for some Marvel thing. Does that mean it's an alternate timeline Steve Rogers, you know, who's bad, and maybe it's Mackie versus Evans? I mean, we'll see, because Marvel is about to go into the multiverse with Doctor Strange and the next Spider-Man movie. So Leslie's mind is being blown, and I don't think in a good way from what I can see.
Well, it was
when you add versus. I that's more than my, you know, non-Marvel brain can handle sometimes.
Well, maybe that won't be it. Who knows? That's just me speculating.
Well, but it was always the joke with Jeff Loeb that, ha ha ha, hashtag it's all connected, and we would make fun of him for that. And there was never any real sense that actually, really and truly, things were connected. Obviously, the Disney Plus shows have the same actors from the movie, and therefore there's going to be a connection. How have you, as someone who actually is invested in sort of the working moving pieces within the MCU, how have you felt that these first two Disney Plus series have actually worked in terms of truly being all connected?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally different than the Jeff Loeb joke, right? Like, I feel strongly I have to watch all of these shows, and I never felt that with the Netflix shows, most of which I didn't watch, you know?
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or the Freeform ones or the FX things like Legion, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. I did not watch those or feel the need to. But on this one, oh, I got to see what Baron Zemo's up to. I really feel that strongly. I got to see what he's up to. I got to see what Sharon Carter's up to, or, you know, all these people. So, yeah, I think the connection, it certainly helps, but it's also a barrier for, you know, people like Leslie or, you know, other people I have in my life who don't want to keep up with all these characters. Who is this? You know, like I talked about my wife last time, you know, she loved WandaVision. She checked out 10 minutes of this Falcon and Winter Soldier. It's like, all right, never mind. You know, she likes Daniel Brühl. She's like, oh, he's in this. But that was about as far as she got in terms of any interest.
Did you tell her that there's a supercut of him dancing for a solid hour at a fictional country's disco? And has she watched that?
It was that episode. That wasn't enough to make her care.
Oh, so she started watching 10 minutes of an episode midway through the series.
Yes. Yes.
That was a questionable decision on her part. I'm not sure. So one of the things, Aaron, that a lot of people have been talking about since the finale, and this is obviously a spoiler for anyone who hasn't watched, is what exactly is or isn't happening with Sharon Carter, and if we should be concerned about that character. Are you concerned about that character, or do you think that there are, I've heard Skrulls, for example, listed as a possible explanation for weird things. How are you feeling about where they left that character? And are you offended, shocked, horrified, or whatever?
I'm not offended. A lot of people are offended. You know, I saw it was spoiled for me a little bit because I saw one tweet that was, you know, Peggy Carter's rolling over in her grave. I was like, okay, well, that's, I can imagine what that's about. No, I'm not offended. I think either way, whether it's a Skrull, which probably does make more sense to me, or it's just that she really had a tough time during the blip and became Bab, that's also fine with me. So I think either way, it's always been kind of a funny, cool character, but kind of funny that Steve Rogers was dating his girlfriend's great niece. So whatever, her grandniece. So, you know, they can.
That sounds like a storyline from Friends when Joey is in that awful play. Anyway, I digress. The bigger piece is, I'm curious, you know, do you think that the pandemic impacted what was planned and how this was going to connect maybe to some of the bigger MCU pieces?
Well, it's funny because you asked that on your podcast, right? And don't they always say like, oh, absolutely not. Like, this didn't change things. I mean, we do. There are.
You can tell that it definitely does, right?
Yeah.
Like, the theories are very obvious, especially with WandaVision.
There's a lot of theories that, you know, I mean, there are rumors that there were cameos cut from this. I mean, the only one I've been able to, I did learn that Florence Pugh filmed something for this. She's going to be in Black Widow, which was supposed to come out before Falcon and Winter Soldier. And she was nowhere to be found. I mean, there are other rumors about other actors. I mean, Florence Pugh is going to be in Black Widow. She's going to show up in Hawkeye later this year. So we'll have more of her. I have no idea what it was she shot or what that would have been, but it's kind of... So I think there were a few things maybe cut out due just to the timeline and when things were released.
Wow, you just spoiled that we missed out on a Florence Pugh cameo, and I am now so angry at Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I am unforgivable, guys. This is really, that's just horrible.
Well, let's look forward now. So we know that the next Marvel show that's up is Loki, which is coming in June, right, on Disney Plus. What do we know about that so far? And, you know, having, you know, if you're just a fan of the Loki character, can you come into this? Obviously, no one's seen it. They haven't sent screeners or anything. Marvel's very secretive. But do we think that you need to have seen WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier, or will Loki kind of be another kind of similar to Falcon, a standalone show?
I get the sense that it's a standalone in the same way that maybe WandaVision is. I mean, we'll see, but, you know, it's a Loki, it's an alternate version of Loki. Loki died in the MCU, but this is one, I mean, that basically he picks up after the events of 2012's The Avengers, right? So he's kind of a different Loki, a more villainous Loki. He didn't have the redemption arc. So I think that sounds like a lot of fun, like he's a little bit back to his bad roots. And so I imagine that you could just watch this and, you know, enjoy Tom Hiddleston. He's one of those MCU actors that I think is very, even if you don't really care about the MCU, you probably enjoy Tom Hiddleston as Loki. You know, he's fun.
And as a teaser for our listeners, we've got an interview with Loki head writer Michael Waldron lined up for June. So that's coming soon.
I always enjoy those that you guys do. It's really fun with especially just having the two interviewers, I think kind of balances it out nice and makes it fun. You got a good, so I look forward to that.
And with the Marvel people, there's a lot of game of cat and mouse that has to be played based on what they can and can't say. So who knows? But yes, so thank you so much for joining us, Aaron, and everyone should always read all of your writing over at the Heat Vision blog at THR.
And you can subscribe to the Heat Vision newsletter, which is a must read, filled with lots of scoops, not just about the comic scene, but all encompassing, including video games and everything for the fanboy audience. It's a great read.
Thanks for that plug. See you guys.
Number three.
Up third this week, the Oscars were a thing that happened, or so I've read. Minari and Nomadland won as expected, but the show Experiment at Union Station kind of went off the rails with a big surprise that, well, Scott Feinberg basically predicted on our show last weekend.
I don't remember that. What did Scott predict?
Everyone was expecting this Chadwick Boseman to win. Scott said that there was a very good chance that Anthony Hopkins could sneak in there and win, and that's exactly what happened. And it kind of changed how producers envisioned the show ending. Dan?
There is no question that producers assumed that Chadwick Boseman was going to win the Best Actor Oscar. There is no other justifiable reason for why they decided to move Best Picture generally in recent years. Scott Feinberg says that it has not been the case for the entirety of the Academy's history, but in my lifetime, Best Picture has always been the last award. This year, it went anti-penultimate, as I like to say. It was third to last. And that was a weird decision. It meant that you had Nomadland winning Best Picture, and then they had to go and go to commercial and come back and give two more awards, which was not really what anyone would structurally suggest. And to make matters even worse, the only reason to do it was to have Chadwick Boseman's widow make the, you know, emotional last speech and to have that as being the impact moment of the telecast. Instead, Anthony Hopkins won. And Anthony Hopkins had apparently, this is being reported widely, asked if he could do an acceptance speech via Zoom because he didn't want to at 5 in the morning British time go into one of the places that they'd set up. And who can blame him? Why are you going to make an 83-year-old man at 5 in the morning go into a studio to record something when he could just do it on his couch? Anthony Hopkins got technology. You can send him a better router if you need to. So instead, there was no speech from Anthony Hopkins. Apparently, there was also the possibility that Olivia Colman was going to accept the award for him. And for some reason, that didn't happen. And because it was a telecast without a host, there was no one to wrap things up. Definitely, in some circumstances, the person presenting the Best Actor Oscar, if they were a quicker on their feet personality, would have found a way to wrap up the show with some personality. You know, if George Clooney had won Best Actor, he would have found a way to wrap up the show. Joaquin Phoenix, not so much with the fast on his feet, witty, well, that's been a great show. Thanks for coming out, y'all. No. So instead, it ended up being this, not just anticlimax, it just vanished. The show ended and no one knew what had happened or why it had happened or why any decision had been made. And so that was the lingering element of the 93rd Academy Awards was, oh, they rearranged the entire show so that someone who wasn't there could accept the last award the next morning, not in the telecast. Yeah, that didn't work.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that also vanished was viewers. Continuing the trend of award shows during the pandemic, ratings hit an all-time low for the ceremony. 10.4 million viewers, that's down 56% from last year. And it matches the same thing about the Emmys and the Grammys and every other pandemic era produced award show has seen its ratings dramatically fall off. So not a surprise there, Dan.
Definitely not a surprise. I think without any question, it was a guarantee that the ratings were going to fall off. My estimate would have been a roughly 50% fall off. Well, it was 56, as you say. So yeah, that's a big fall off. And it's a fall off for almost all live events. Even the Super Bowl was down this year. It was not down 56% because that would have been insane.
No, people still watch football, but you know, when you've got a lot of these movies were only available theatrically or on streaming services that not everybody subscribes to, this was a weird year for movies when people can't go to the movie theaters or they didn't subscribe to the streaming platform or they just didn't watch them because there was not the conversation around them wasn't the same. So
it was a different year. And so everyone is going to make whatever excuses they want to make. And everyone generally will find their monolithic excuse and make it as if that's the thing. So plenty of conservatives are like, no one wants to hear from woke Hollywood. And do I think that has an impact on the audience? Yeah, of course it does. Without any question, there's an impact. Do I think it's a 50% audience drop impact? No. And anyone saying that is just dumb. There's nothing else to say about it. It's just stuck in their own perspective. But did it make an impact on the audience? Of course. Did it make an impact on the audience that the movies that were selected are probably a slightly nichier group? But yeah, absolutely. Bill Maher went off on a thing about how people want upbeat movies and why don't they have upbeat movies at the Oscars anymore, as he showed a clip of Schindler's List. It just dumb shit. But on the other hand, sure, some of the movies were a little bit of a downer. And there were a couple of New York Times columns about the lack of populist nominated movies. And yeah, it's kind of true, but it's only true if you ignore, for example, that Steven Spielberg's West Side Story was supposed to be released in time for Oscar contention this year, and that would have made a difference. A bunch of movies weren't released this year because there was this pandemic thing that shut down movie theaters, and some people decided they didn't want to just put their things up on their streaming platform. this just happened, you know? What are you supposed to say? That they blew it? Some people earlier were suggesting maybe there was no reason to have Oscars this year. No, there were a lot of good movies nominated for Oscars this year, and there were a lot of good movies that came out. And as I keep saying over and over again, a lot of the movies were more available than ever before this year. You could have watched Nomadland for 2 months on Hulu, and not everyone has Hulu, I understand. And not everyone has Hulu and Netflix and Amazon. So, you know, that's where it starts coming into this, is do I think the movies were more available in a general sense? Yes, but it is absolutely bubble-ish of me, or myopic of me, to think that everybody at home has 7 streaming services and wants to have 7 streaming services so that they can somehow cobble together a year's worth of the theatrical experience. Yeah, there's no question. But on the other hand, if you had Hulu, if you had Hulu, Amazon, and Netflix, you could have, before Oscar night, seen all 5 of the documentary contenders, all 5 of the foreign film contenders, from the comfort of your own house. And that's not something that's always the case. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that actually brings us to our next thing. We got a mailbag question from Kevin, who wonders, with the 60% drops in ratings for the Oscars, if we can see a time when these award shows are either, in the case of the Globes or the Oscars, just become streamed events, or where they cease to exist at all. Because in Kevin's point of view, he seems like the general public no longer has a taste for them. Well, you kind of touched on this, but yeah, this, you know, 56% drop was expected. Everyone, even before the ceremony, was saying there was no way it was going to be anything but down. And, you know, even, you know, Dan, your guess was 50%. And, you know, I think it's unfair to generalize that the public doesn't care for these award shows because the ratings are down. Well, this was an atypical year. And, you know, talking about the future of the Golden Globes is a completely different conversation based on everything that's wrong with the HFPA right now.
But we had that conversation last week. We had that conversation in full last week.
Right. But so what NBC chooses to do with the Golden Globes is unrelated to ratings right now. There's so many other things going on there. But in terms of award shows, they're still appealing to a broadcast audience, because broadcast networks need viewers to tune in live. Watch live. That is still the end all be all of the broadcast model. Tune in live. We can charge more for ads. It's an ages old system. So, you know, there's no way that these award shows are ever going to go away. And if they wind up on streaming, that would be a huge paradigm shift. So, but you're starting to see that happen with the NHL. There was a big deal this week where NBC is no longer going to have the National Hockey League games. Instead, it's going to Warner Media, which is going to air them on TBS and TNT and possibly on HBO Max. But that's still linear, right? TNT and TBS are basic cable networks, or ad-supported cable networks. Most households still have them. You know, even if you're a cord cutter, you can still probably find a way. I'm sure by the time they start televising this, that they'll have some ad-supported thing on HBO Max where you can tune in and watch hockey games live. So, yeah, I don't think that award shows will ever vanish from broadcast. Not right now.
And also, we said this last week regarding the discussion about the Golden Globes. The Golden Globes discussion and whether the Golden Globes continue to exist is a completely separate question from the ratings for the Golden Globes. But even under those circumstances, the 5.6 or however many million people who watched that Golden Globes telecast, in this very, very weird world of television fragmentation, 5 to 6 million live viewers who are actually sitting there and watching every ad you have in that time period, That's an audience that networks can work with. And so if that's an audience that networks can work with, then 10.4 million viewers for the Oscars, ABC can still be very happy about that. They can't be relatively happy, because probably they can look back and remember what the audiences were last year. But 10.4 million viewers who watched commercials, and the commercials were very integrated into the programming. You had the big In the Heights trailer rollout. You had the big West Side Story teaser rollout, et cetera, et cetera. That is valuable space. Also, the ratings for the Oscars will improve next year. I don't think this is one where it's an endless downward spiral. I do think that the show needs a host. I think we've moved past the hostless shows are cool and fun thing, because I think a lot of the problem with this year's Oscars ratings were that people didn't really know they were happening at all. And part of that is because if you don't have a host, it's a tough thing to promote around. You know, I'm not saying I want Billy Crystal back next year, but maybe I do. Maybe it's time to bring Billy Crystal back to set things right. Billy Crystal hosting the Oscars would be like the electing Joe Biden president of the Oscars. It would be like, okay, we're going to bring back this old school person who maybe isn't hip and maybe isn't progressive in all the ways we want, but we know he can probably get the job done. I think if they brought back Billy Crystal next year, spent 3 months saying, doing promotions, Billy's back, baby, at the Oscars, I think ratings would go up dramatically. I think you'd get 15 to 20 million people without any question for that. If you had Billy Crystal hosting, purely as a hypothetical, but if you get someone better, that's fine too.
How about Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish?
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, why did they not do it this year? They're promoting a movie, for heaven's sakes. If you had Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish hosting the Oscars this year, ratings would have been better. I think that's true. And I think it is. I think we had the cool period where everyone was thinking we don't need hosts and it's going to be great. And it worked so well that first time that the Oscars tried it that everyone made the mistake of thinking that's a solution. It's not a solution. It's an opportunity or an alternative. And that's the mistake that I think everyone has made. The, oh, we don't need hosts. I don't think you do need hosts, but I think you don't not need them. I think there's a reason why you have hosts. Hosts can set a tone. Hosts can handle when you give out your last award of the night to someone who isn't there and make sure that the thing ends. There's a lot that hosts can do that is worthwhile. I think a good host and one or two movies that people actually saw in theaters, and God bless, people are returning to theaters, and that is good. 50% of us are 100% inoculated, and one of us will be getting our second shot next week, and maybe I can start fantasizing about going to the movies again. Maybe not. But yeah, I think this is not a permanent problem. I think the Golden Globes are a permanent problem because it's systemic. It's in the marrow. It is cancerous, what NBC has. The Oscars are not cancerous. They are a situation where it's very much circumstantial, and I think they can be fixed. And I think that basically all of the award shows other than the Golden Globes can be fixed. You can still do the Emmys. They won't get 20 million viewers ever again. Sorry, it's not going to happen. And the Oscars will not get 45 to 50 million viewers ever again. Just not going to happen. But will the Oscars someday potentially get 15 to 20 million viewers? 100%. Next year, if they get the right combination of things. So yeah, I don't think award shows are dead. The only award show that is dead and should be dead is the Golden Globes. And we talked about that last week.
Yes. Well, moving on. Up next, it's our showrunner spotlight segment.
Number four.
I'm thrilled to introduce this week. Our guest is Stephen Canals, the co-creator, writer, exec producer, and director of Pose, the groundbreaking ballroom drama that returns this weekend with its third and final season on FX. Thank you for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get started with the final season announcement. I was stunned when the news came in that it was ending with season three. I went back and read some of your previous interviews with THR, where you said that you envisioned Pose running between 4 and 6 seasons, but you knew that it would end when you felt like you had told the story that you set out to tell. And then I tuned into a conference call that you had with reporters earlier this week when you said that season three was always a three-act narrative. So can you talk us through when you knew season three was going to be it? What were the discussions that led up to that? And like when the show was renewed early for season three a few years ago, were you aware then that this was the end? Like, talk us through how that decision came in, because that's, you know, for a show that that's this groundbreaking, that is award-winning, Peabody, Emmy, so important to visibility and a community and remains a critical darling, 3 seasons even seems short, even if this was on Netflix.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a big part of the decision to end the narrative now had everything to do with the very first conversation that Ryan Murphy and I had when we met about, when we first met, about what the show could be. And I had obviously pitched the series, a very different version of the series. You know, my original pilot was very dark. You know, and in the course of working with Ryan and with Brad Falchuk, it became more of a found family story. But we agreed about what the end point would be. And I know, Leslie, you've now seen the series finale. So what you see in our series finale is one of the things we talked about, you know, that first 45 minutes. And throughout the course of breaking narrative for the first season, we always knew that that was the end goal, that that was what we were slowly marching toward. And so I think, you know, like going back to my earlier statements about how many seasons the show could go, I always knew that that's what we were working toward. And, you know, once we went back in the room to begin breaking season three, it just felt so clear to me that that's what this third season want it to be about. We've time jumped season two and season three. And I think as a result of doing that, it certainly accelerated our timeline. But outside of being a show about chosen family, the show was always grounded and rooted in what was happening culturally and sociopolitically in New York. And so it felt to us, more specifically, I should say, it felt to me like I didn't want us to avoid talking about the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and specifically, you know, when it was at its fever pitch, which is 1994, which is where we've placed our third season. And so really, I mean, it wasn't a difficult decision, to be honest. I mean, I think we were sad, obviously, to say, oh, well, we're at the end and this is it. But it just felt right. And I think, as you pointed out, you know, as a lover of television, I've just always been so bothered when shows are clearly just creating episodes and creating seasons of TV just for the sake of it. You know, and I understand the importance of visibility, and I think, you know, I know that the audience is going to be disappointed and probably will feel like this is all just a line. But the truth is, like, I really was thinking about the audience as much as I was thinking about the characters when making the decision to end the narrative here. You know, I just didn't want to be that show that stayed at the party too long, you know? And it felt like we so clearly know what the end goal is. And so when it's right in your eye line, it's like, okay, do we make a right turn and go in a different direction just to belabor getting to the end goal? Or do we just keep walking a straight path and just allow ourselves to arrive at that end goal? And so that was a decision that we made.
You know, so the final season, you know, the theme, you've said before that it's kind of an exploration of dreams. And if achieving them is everything that, you know, if it really is everything that you've wanted once you have them. So can you talk us through, like, you know, from a 30,000 foot point of view, if that's what the final season theme is, how does it fit in with the first two? Like, what's the larger construct?
Well, I would hope that for anybody watching it, but specifically for our young queer and trans audience, that they would be affirmed in their dreams. You know, that they would know by watching the journeys of Blanca and Electra and Angel and pray tell that they're allowed to dream and to dream big, you know, and to go out for those dreams and to be unapologetic in the choices that they have to make that dream a reality. You know, the first season, if you go back to the first season, every single one of our principal characters at some point, many in the pilot, but in the first season, say exactly what their greatest dream is, what their hope is for the future, what it is that they most desire. And so this third season, we came into it saying, we're going to give those characters the things that they asked for and then allow the season to be an exploration into all the complications that can happen once that dream is, once you're confronted by the dream, once it's right there in your grasp, how do you navigate life?
Well said. You know, the other piece that I wanted to talk about too is, you know, we know that in this, you know, obviously lots of vaccines getting into arms, but we're still in a pandemic, and we know that that scripted shows are more expensive and take considerably longer to produce during the pandemic. And you've got a final season that's only 7 episodes. That's down from 8 in season 1 and 10 in season 2, obviously the lowest order to date. But in a larger sense, how did the pandemic impact the types of stories that you wanted and were able to tell in this final season?
It's an interesting question. And I think to go back to your first question around the decision, I think if there was ever going to be any doubt, and really and truthfully there wasn't, but if there was ever going to be a doubt about whether or not the story that we tell in the third season should be told, everything that's happened since March of 2020 solidified, no, we absolutely need to be telling this story. Because the truth is, like, we knew what we were barreling toward. And then, you know, the pandemic hit. And for sure, there were adjustments that we had to make when production went back up in September of 2020. So we were down for 6 months. And I think you see, you know, the stories in episodes 3 and 4 were set before the pandemic. So one of those episodes, episodes 4, is a bottle episode. And so that was what it was. But I think once we came back in September of 2020 to start filming, you know, there were all these new mandates regarding how to shoot safely in the midst of a pandemic. And obviously we were filming in New York, and New York was just sort of coming out of having been in lockdown. And in a lot of ways, I think we were one of the first productions. And so in a lot of ways, even though Disney was ultra supportive, we were moving at times, not quite being able to see, you know, we didn't always have clarity on things. And I think part of that had to do with, like, we were like, it's all brand new, you know? So for example, when we were location scouting, you know, we'd find a really great spot. And then the minute that the folks who owned that location heard how big the crew was going to be, you know, then they would say, okay, we don't know that you can film here anymore. And so we had to make a lot of adjustments to deal with all of the restrictions in the city. And so, you know, the ball scenes and having less ball scenes was part of that, because obviously to keep folks safe, we had to dramatically reduce the numbers. And so hopefully, you tell me, because you've seen the season now, hopefully the ball scenes that we do have still feel full and vibrant and similar to previous seasons. But the reality is that a lot of that was creative editing. Like, we had to be really strategic about how we used our background actors, and we were really limited. So we went from having 125 to 150 background actors in our ball scenes in the first two seasons. This season, we could never have more than 35 to 40. And so it was really, really difficult to film those scenes. We really had to work around, you know, with, it was camera angles, and then there was VFX work as well. And so it was challenging, and it took up a lot of time, you know, so that definitely impacted things.
I mean, the only thing that I noticed was that there were fewer ball scenes, but the ones that there are still pretty epic in scale. So I didn't notice that big of a manpower difference, but it's pretty impressively executed. So Dan, I'll let you take the next one here. I feel like I'm hogging this conversation.
No problem at all. I want to talk a little bit about the time period that we're set here on a couple different levels. As you say, it's 1994. One thing I thought was very funny is that the very first line of the entire season that's audible is "fuck you, Rudy Giuliani." So if you want to talk about things that are resonant in 2020 and 2021 and also in 1994, there's one. How did you decide that he was going to be sort of the background villain of this season? And then how did you decide that the thing that was going to bring some of these characters together was going to be the OJ situation?
Well, as we began breaking the third season, I'm going to take you back even further, which is we have a text chain as well as an email chain for the five of us in the writer's room. So myself, Ryan Murphy, Brad Falchuk, Janet Mock, and Our Lady J. And we've been the same five folks who have worked to construct narrative since the first season. And so in between seasons, we're always, you know, sending each other ideas, and we're always sending each other articles. And so anyhow, so, you know, after season two, prior to season three, we had had a conversation about where we should land for the third season. And, you know, I think that I would be lying if I didn't say that every season of Pose, we obviously are hyper aware of everything that's happening in our country, and that those things obviously will at times impact and inform narrative, right? So the first season, for example, you had that the Donald Trump's identity looming large, right? And we saw that through the character that James Vanderbeek played. And so, you know, this season, well, prior to going into the room for the third season, we were having conversations about, you know, what year is it and what is happening in New York at that time. And, you know, our show has always centered the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And more specifically, I think we were really interested in, again, like, what were all the restrictions and things that were happening in New York at that time. And, you know, once Giuliani became mayor, you know, the focus was to clean up the city. So that version of New York that we saw in season one and in season two is very different going into this third season. And I think that was a really interesting place for us to ground the narrative. And so I think to go back to your question, Leslie, about why ending it in the third season, that was a large part of it, right? It was like once we knew we were going to land in 94 and that we were interested in looking at what did, you know, Giuliani's efforts to clean the city look like and how did it impact our community? You know, it just, we realized, oh, well, then if we're in 94, then we're at the height of the epidemic. And so, you know, it's like all the story and all the things that would be impacting our characters just came naturally out of that choice. So, you know, every season we've always had really long, meaty, intentional conversations about what year is it and what specifically is happening in New York. So that was really the beginning. And then in terms of OJ specifically, you know, we'd had a conversation once we decided 1994 and we were interested in investigating, you know, how does New York's cleanup impact our characters and where does that lead them? And I think the character who has the most interesting narrative connected to that is Elektra. But we then had to then take a step back and say, okay, so what are all the narrative arcs for each one of our characters? You know, and so then we start to lay out the groundwork for this is where we see the character at the beginning. And then once we did that and we started talking about each character, what we realized is that, again, that each one of our characters seemed to be running towards something in the same way that they seem to be running away from something. And so I think kind of monolithically, all of our characters were running away from this old version of themselves and the life that they used to live. And all of them are now running toward and hopefully capturing all those dreams that I talked about earlier that they stated they wanted in the first season. And so in the course of talking about that, we were like, you know, what's something interesting that happened in 94 that seems to really exemplify that theme? And immediately, you know, Ryan Murphy was like, well, there is one thing, but, you know, I don't know if that's exactly the way we want to go. And then he said it out loud and it just made sense. Like for all of us, it clicked. We were like, no, yes, it absolutely should be OJ, because here we have this man who literally is running, you know, running from the law. You know, and it makes so much sense, because it's a literal representation of exactly what is happening to all of our characters when we pick up with them in the third season. And so it made sense. And the other thing is that, and this is the truth, that when you watch the premiere, all the conversations that our characters are having about the law and having about specifically Black men in our culture, that was all written and that was all filmed prior to the pandemic and everything that happened last summer. So it's just so interesting that that conversation is timely. Those scenes, in fact, those were the only scenes that Janet Mock shot March of 2020 prior to us being shut down. So who knew that we were writing this and that now, a year later, that it was going to be so urgent and necessary?
It strikes me that the first two seasons would have been outside of young Steven's perspective of the world, but that as we hit 1994, this may be a world that you at least have some awareness of. Does that change your own personal connection to the storytelling as we reach a season where you actually were a teenager, you were sort of cognizant of what was happening?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and observation. I mean, I was in the first season, it was 1987, I was 7 years old. So I certainly wasn't old enough to completely comprehend everything that was happening. But my life was directly impacted by both crack and AIDS. You know, I had both of those epidemics loom large in my neighborhood. You know, I had family members who were dealing with addiction. And then, you know, we had a family friend who died of AIDS. And so, you know, so much of the work on Pose has been my own personal version of therapy and working through living through those traumas, you know, and trying to make sense of it for myself. I think in terms of 1994 specifically, and now the, you know, where the third season takes place and my being 14, for sure, you know, I think back to that time, and my understanding of it then is still very different than the way that I now at 40 understand and comprehend and wrestle with all of it. It's interesting. At 14, I remember those conversations around Giuliani, for example, cleaning up the city. And you saw that, I think, most dramatically at that time with Times Square, right? Like that was the place where you were seeing the cleanup. And I remember thinking at the time at 14, like, oh, this is a good thing. This is going to make the city safer. It's so fascinating now as an adult to reflect on that period and to do my own investigation and research on it and to realize that, you know, the system was created and the system works as it was intended to, which is to hold certain people down and to disenfranchise them. And so this lack of safety that I perceived the city to have wasn't about a lack of safety. It was all about survival. It was people on the streets doing what they could so that they could make a way out of no way. And so it's really interesting to see, to understand it in that way now. And it certainly impacted the writing. You know, I think I have a lot more understanding and empathy, not only for these characters' experiences, but certainly for the real people that I know who were making choices in 1994 that I was very quick to judge, that now as an adult, I say, no, like that choice was necessary. It was a choice that they had to make because they had to survive, you know? And I think that, to your question, we explore that in the third episode with Elektra and her arc, you know, because I think that her story isn't unique. You know, like that was happening to a lot of folks at that time.
Now, you mentioned the show as a way of processing trauma, and in the second episode, a newly introduced character, Lisa, tells the characters that, quote, queer people deal with an unfair amount of trauma, and there's been a lot of talk lately from writers and critics of color about exhaustion of stories about Black trauma, and that as being a primary representation of the experience. as you've been arcing the show out and making sure that, you know, as you mentioned, the family, the community aspects, those things come to the center, how important has it been for you to consistently not make this sort of quote unquote the queer trauma show that is the centerpiece?
You know, I think that being a queer Afro-Latin person, I know what it means to live in this body, holding both of those identities, navigating the world. And I am not my traumas, you know. I am a mix of a whole bunch of things, you know. And some days I'm happy and some days I'm sad. And some days I'm both at the same time. And, you know, like, we are a multitude of things. And so for me, Pose at its core was always about honoring all facets of our experiences and our personalities. And it hasn't been as hard to do. You know, I think that Hollywood writ large is just very near, like, just narrow and nearsighted. And, you know, it's like, sure, you only really want to know, you only ever want to tell narratives about folks of color when we're, like, disenfranchised and having to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And, you know, it's like, but we, the people who are living these lives, like, we know the truth. And so it's like, allow us to lean into the joy. And I think it isn't by chance that the Pose takes place at a time where there were so many things coming. It isn't by chance that Pose was constructed to take place at a time when queer and trans people and folks of color were still fighting for their existence and still fighting to be heard. I mean, frankly, we're still fighting for all those things now. But, you know, but it was very difficult. It's hard now. It was really hard then. And the reason for that was to show that even in the midst of all of it, that there was still joy and there was still love and a camaraderie. And I mean, that's the experience I had. Like, yes, I grew up poor in housing projects in the South Bronx, you know? And yeah, and like, it was in the midst of both the crack and AIDS epidemics. And I had a front row seat, even as a little boy, to all of that. And yet, you know, I wouldn't change anything. You know, it impacted my life, sure, but it also made me who I am. And I think there are a lot of folks who feel that way. And I think Pose was always, for me, a way to honor that experience, to honor the lives that lived in that environment and all the lives that we lost in that environment. And to say that, you know, we are, again, we are so much more than the trauma and so much more than the hurt. You know, and I hope that we start moving to a place where we can see more Black and brown joy and queer and trans joy, because we deserve it.
In the original version of the pilot that you wrote, the one that you talked about earlier that was sort of the darker version, did the sources of joy come from different places?
I think that similar to the to what Pose became, I always saw the ballroom scenes as being the light in the dark. And the truth is that when Ryan and I met, I don't know if I've ever, I think I've talked about this a little here and there, but when Ryan and I met, he had just acquired the rights to Paris is Burning. And so when we met, we decided we were going to adapt, we were going to do a faithful adaptation of the documentary. So the original draft that we co-wrote with Brad Falchuk, Pepa LaBeija and Dorian Corey and Venus Extravaganza and all the individuals who you meet in Paris is Burning, like, they were the cast of the show. And we wrote that draft, and then we rewrote that draft. And we just, I think we were feeling really limited with having to, you know, honor real lives and real people. And so that's when we went back to my original draft. And so we went back to the original draft and we rewrote that. And it was in the midst of, I think there's like four uniquely different Pose pilots that exist. So we wrote that, and then we wrote another draft of it. And we were, at that point, we were writing the second episode. And the show at that point, you know, was really honoring the darker themes that were in my first draft that I wrote solo. And it was in the midst of writing the second episode. I just remember I walked into the writer's room, and at that point it was still only Brad, Falchuk, Ryan, and I. And he said to me, you know, I think that we might be breaking this all wrong. And I was like, you think? I was like, it feels good to me. And at that time, like, I mean, I had just come out of a MFA screenwriting program at UCLA. And so, you know, my hope was always to have Pose air on like a Showtime or an HBO, right? Like I wanted it really dark. Like The Wire was my comp. So he was like, yeah, I don't know that we broke it right. And I was like, okay, I'm like, well, you know, let's, and so we talked about it. And the thing that he said that so deeply resonated with me, and I'll never forget it, is he was like, all the joy that you have about being a queer person of color, like I want to feel that joy on the page. And that just changed everything. It completely 180'd everything. And so we went back to the pilot, and it became the show that you now know. We leaned all the way into the joy, and it became a show. It stopped being a show about the grit and the darkness of, I mean, I think it is still that, but it wasn't solely a show about the grittiness of existing on the streets of New York. It really became a show about chosen family.
Well, was the Dorian Corey Mummy in the Closet, was that a direct tie into when you guys were adapting Paris is Burning, or was that just something where down the road you're like, okay, we really, this is too good a story not to find a way to bring it into our world?
Yeah, I think it was the latter. I think we were just like, no, it's still a cool story. Like, we should use that at some point and do it as like a nod, because obviously I think we've always felt from the very beginning that Pose was in conversation with Paris is Burning, and we certainly didn't want to ignore it and act like, because I think for most people, you know, particularly for queer people, I think Paris is Burning really is your first introduction to the ballroom community, especially if you're not from New York. And so it was really important for us to still honor those individuals. And that's why, like, in the second season, we had the quotes after episodes. You know, a lot of it was always, I mean, overall, our show is always trying to honor all of our forebears and the people who have come before us.
Well said. And one of the things that I love so much about it, and, you know, watching, you know, season one, I was just kind of blown away after watching the pilot and just seeing something completely different and just identifying with so many of these characters and feeling my own struggle in coming out and, you know, just seeing that representation. And it always takes me back to something the Queer as Folk original series creators for the US, the Showtime adaption, said. And they, you know, that when that show, which was groundbreaking for Showtime at the time, they said people came for the queer, but they stayed for the folk. And at the same time, that show helped open so many eyes and turn, you know, and do so much for acceptance, you know, like, you know, people who may not have had gay friends felt like they had gay friends. People who may not now have say that they don't understand or know people who are transgender definitely feel that they know them now because of this show, you know. And I think that's why this, your art specifically, is so important, you know. And look, Pose will always have a huge place in the TV history books after featuring the largest cast of trans actors playing trans characters, among other feats like Billy Porter's historic Emmy win. You know, so I guess my question in all of this is, knowing that this was the final season and knowing where the last signpost was, and knowing that you have done so much to showcase real issues that are happening in our world today, even though the show was set in the late 80s and early 90s, how much pressure did you feel about sticking the landing, considering how important this show is, not just to your own community, but as a whole?
Here's the truth. I suppose if I really sat and thought about it, I would have felt an immense amount of pressure. But the reality is that we have such a loving and faithful audience. And so many people have rallied around us, right? Like, I'm going to go back to the first season when we were filming, which I would say that was the point in time where I was riddled with the most anxiety, because no one knew what the show was. No one knew what it could be. And I think I still had all the messaging in my head from the 166 meetings that I went to, where I was being told a show like this has no value. you know, no one's ever going to green light this. I don't know where a show like this lives. I don't know who the audience is. So while we were filming it, I was like, I don't know, is it going to work? Like, there was just always a sense, I felt good about what we were writing. I felt great about what we were filming. And yet I was like, I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know. I just don't know that people are going to understand it. And then that first wave of reviews came out, you know, and folks like yourself said beautiful things about the show. And then the show debuted and we found an audience. And then, you know, the award shows came and they started giving us accolades and, you know, we were on top 10 lists. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, wow, people get it. And they actually seem to really like it. And so there hasn't been any pressure for the previous, you know, for season two, and certainly not for season three, because for me, it's like, well, they're there. Like, they understand the heart space and the story that we're trying to tell. And, you know, I think that for me, the work has always felt like a meal, right? So it's like Pose in essence is a restaurant, and each episode is the course of a really tasty, you know, hopefully two to three star Michelin meal. And, you know, it's like you have a choice. Either you're going to come to our restaurant and you're going to sit and enjoy the meal, or you're not. And sometimes that meal is not going to be great for everybody, you know, and that's okay. But there's never been any pressure about the ingredients that we're using to cook said meal. You know, and I've never had any doubt about the courses, because the reality is, like, you know, the people who have been coming to our restaurant from the beginning are the same folks who have been coming for the past 2 years.
And all of your chefs are part of this community. You know, Our Lady J, Janet Mock, yourself, Ryan Murphy. You know, it's
exactly.
You know, yeah.
And our token straight white guy, Brad Falchuk, who I adore. Right. And so it's like, you know, we have a grade A group of chefs cooking a really great meal. And so, you know, it's like, we just want you to come and sit and commune with us.
Right. And then you have this incredibly talented cast led by Billy Porter. And my favorite character on the show is MJ Rodriguez's Blanca. You know, and I do want to talk, you know, obviously with so many people involved in having a hand in making this a real authentic story, not just from the writing point, but from the on-screen portrayals and these characters, you know, what was important? Did you have a conversation with the cast members and Billy and MJ and everyone else about what they wanted? Or was there something that Our Lady J or Janet Mock or yourself that was really important to get into this final season?
We didn't have conversations with the cast about story that they would want to tell. The thing that we'll do every season is once we are writing episodes, like, we'll have conversations with the cast to finesse things, you know. So episode four, for example, obviously Billy Porter grew up in the Black church, and so, you know, we had conversations with him, for example, about, like, what song would you be interested in singing? So they definitely aid us in informing choices in scripts. In terms of us in the room, I would say yes. There absolutely were story choices and things that were really important to us. I don't know how to talk about them without spoiling things, but I think, you know, like, the arc that you see in episodes 5 and 6, and particularly episode 6, which is written and directed by Janet Mock, like, that was a story that she pitched in the room that was very important for her, especially as a Black trans woman, to be able to tell that story, you know, and so that was really beautiful. You know, I know for me, one of the stories that was really important was, oof, again, it's like, it's always hard to talk about things without ruining it. But Blanca's choice at the end of the premiere was something that was really important to me, and a thread that I wanted to see, you know, throughout the season, and obviously leads to where we find her in the finale. You know, so that was an important part of the story. So yeah, I mean, we always collectively, we come together as a room and we talk about all the things that we're the most excited by. And, you know, and then we kind of throw it all up on the wall and we see what sticks.
The season also has some of Elektra's most quotable moments to date. As kind of a two-pronged question, I'm curious, as you're shooting the pilot in the first season, what was it like realizing some of the things that Dominique can get away with saying? And what has it been like to sort of steer into giving her these amazingly colorful and quotable things to say? Is there someone in your five-person writer's room who's particularly good with coming up with the Elektra lines?
Dominique Jackson can get away with saying everything. She is fantastic. I cannot wait. Oh, you haven't seen episode 5 yet, Dan. So
I haven't gotten that far.
I can't wait for you to watch episode 5. There is an epic read in the 5th episode, and that is one. I think when that episode airs, I'll post what was originally written, because she ad-libbed parts of it, and it was like, her ad-libs were so good. And I love Dominique, because she's nothing like Elektra. So it's like, I'm directing that scene with her, and we're filming it, and she throws in her ad-libs, and I'm at the monitor like, I can't with her. She's so good. And so then I go in and I'm like, let me give you a small adjustment. And she's, she's so sweet. But she was like, was that okay? She was like, is that okay? I threw those lines. I mean, I can take them out. And I was like, no, they're great. Leave them all in. And she's like, okay. She's magic. But no, in terms of our room, everybody works hard and contributes, and we all throw shady lines. I'm probably the least shady in terms of the line. I'm like, comedy's hard for me. So I'm always like, I look to everybody else to kind of spruce things up. But I will say the person who is like great at coming up with those Elektra reads that always make us cackle is Brad Falchuk. Like it's hysterical. Like he'll say something and we're all like, okay, that's got to go in. So he's really fantastic, but everybody's great.
You know, one of the things that it's so interesting about when you're the first of a show, right? You know, obviously Transparent came before Pose, but now Pose has really elevated the storytelling. But, you know, how have you seen the portrayals of the trans community in film and television evolve since Pose arrived? I mean, you know, just before we started recording, I got a press release about a premiere date for a ballroom competition series called Legendary on HBO Max, returning for season 2. I mean, that's progress.
Yeah, and what's cool about Legendary is that a lot of our Pose family members are part of Legendary. So Jack Mizrahi, who is, you know, our staff writer and has also is featured on this show as one of the MC council. He's a writer and a producer of Legendary. And then we have Deshaun, who is the MC of Legendary, who is also in the House of Wintour on Pose. And then we have Laomi, who's in the House of Ferocity and was a choreographer on our show, is one of the judges on Legendary. So it's cool to see how, they were incredible folks prior to Pose, but the combination of their being part of Ballroom and Pose has now led to their being part of Legendary, which is super cool. I think that representation is still evolving when it comes to the trans community. I know that conversations that I'm having privately with folks, it feels like people are being more intentional in terms of casting, for example. You know, so I'm hearing about and seeing less of folks creating narratives where they are casting cisgendered actors in trans roles. And so that's progress. With that said, you know, I think that what made Pose so groundbreaking, even before it ever aired, was that we had cast not one, but 5 trans women of color in series regular roles. While it's great that I'm seeing more trans representation in film and TV, there still only ever seems to be enough space for one. You know, and I think, again, what made Pose so groundbreaking, revolutionary, was that it wasn't just one. The whole show was populated by queer and trans people. And so I struggle because whenever you have a narrative where there's only enough space for one, you then have to deal with the burden of representation, right? And so that one trans character in that one show now has to be all things for all trans people and represent the entire trans community. And that isn't exactly fair. And so, you know, I think that there's still more, there's more work to be done, is what I'm saying. Additionally, and that, and I should be specific that we're just talking about in front of the camera. So behind the camera is a whole other story, because I'm going to tell on some folks, but when we were in the height of the pandemic and we were in lockdown for those 6 months, I had a number of executive producers and showrunners reaching out to me, specifically asking me about trans talent, you know, producers and writers. And what I realized is that my network, my scope was pretty small. And so I sort of privately went out and I compiled a list of transgender and gender non-binary and non-conforming writers. And so I have a list of 100 people, or at least there's 100 people right now, that I could then send to studios and networks and to managers and agents if they're looking for untapped trans talent on the page. And I think that, you know, it's incredible that Pose exists, but, and I'm so happy for, you know, my sister and my friend and collaborator, Janet Mock, having an overall deal at Netflix, but where are the other Stevens? Where are the other Janets? Where are the other Our Lady J's who also have stories to tell? Because I'm not seeing those shows being greenlit yet. And I think I understand the disappointment that people feel about Pose ending. And I would hope that, you know, while we certainly, we made the decision to end the show, I think it says a lot that people are so disappointed. And part of it, and a lot of people have said to me privately, a lot of it has to do with, well, where are we supposed to turn now to see ourselves? And that to me says everything, that we're still in a place where in the last three seasons, as much as we want to pat ourselves on the back for how wonderful it is that, you know, a show like Pose could exist, it's like, well, where are the other Poses? Where are they? So let's get them made.
And I think it's such an important question with the cast, which is so tremendous. This is great. This is their showcase. Where are we going to see them next? So what have you heard from the actors regarding how people are seeing them? And, you know, are there roles coming? Are people looking at this and going, okay, I want to put you in my show now?
Yes, for sure. I've definitely had a number of conversations with the cast about not simply auditions, but also being offered roles directly, which is really exciting. And the other thing is that our cast is also, they're taking the bull by the horns and they're creating their own opportunities, right? So Billy Porter is going to be directing his first feature. Haley Sahar is developing a feature as well, that she's going to star in. And like, that's exciting, you know, that I think our cast coming out of this show isn't simply going to sit back and wait for opportunities to come to them, but they're also going to create their own opportunities. And that's really exciting.
I love that so much, so much. Knowing how the finale ends, I have to ask, because we always ask in this era, but is the door open for a revival or a spinoff or a movie down the line? You know, what are the odds that we'll see more in this Pose universe?
That's a great question. I'd never say never.
And that'd be what every other showrunner says when asked the same question.
So, you know, like, I'd never say never. I you know, I love these characters so much. And in truth, I'm still in a place of mourning. You know, like, whenever I come to the end of writing something, there's always that... there's always that period of time where I have to allow myself to grieve and say goodbye, because I'm not going to get to spend time with them anymore. So, you know, distance makes the heart grow fonder, even though I adore every single one of these characters. And so, you know, I would never say that, no, that the door is shut, because I absolutely could see, you know, 5-10 years from now, sort of ringing up Ryan and saying, oh my God, I have a really exciting idea. And, you know, let's do another time jump, you know, who knows? But right now I feel really good about the the story that we've told. And I think that in the same way that I, this is going to sound very writerly, but in the same way that I, as a storyteller, I have to take time to fill up my creative well, and I need to go out and live life so that I have something interesting on the page to write. I think that these characters need to go off and they need to live their lives and they need to exist. And in some ways they need to grow up too. And maybe that'll lead both of us to finding each other again and wanting to tell another story years from now.
Yeah. You know, and then you also have another LGBTQ themed project in the works for FX. Do you want to tell us an update, or what's the state of that one?
That's called 81 Words. It's a limited series about the beginnings of the LGBT movement. And we're still in the research phase, to be honest. I haven't started writing it yet. Just putting the pieces of the puzzle together, and it's still it's early, so we're still developing it. But for sure, you know, all of the projects on my slate are definitely affirming stories, and stories that I think folks beyond the LGBTQ community, but specifically LGBTQ folks, will be able to tune into and see themselves and feel that I, as a storyteller, are looking out for them and their best interests.
And we like to end these interviews always with the same question. So what have you been watching and enjoying lately?
Ooh, the show that I most recently binged, and I adore it, I think it's so good, it's so funny, is Generation on HBO Max, which is like this high school narrative. You know, I think like I grew up obviously with like 90210 and Saved by the Bell, you know, and then got a little older, and then it was Dawson's Creek, and you know, Felicity was college, but, and I love Felicity, but so all of these sort of newer high school shows I think are great. Like I love, you know, Euphoria and Sex Education, but Generation has that queer sensibility throughout that just was so unexpected and a little disarming. And I loved it. I was like, oh, I want to watch the whole show now. I was like, just one season? Like, I got to the end of the... You know when you watch something really enjoyable, because when you get to the end, you're like, I just want to watch it again right now. That's how I felt about that. So Generation was great.
And it was created by a teenager. So, I mean, you know.
I know.
Which is, yeah, and you can go back and listen to our interview with the Generation creators from episode 111 from March, which is one of... to me, it's you're speaking my language with all the high school stuff, all the shows that you mentioned. I can't wait for Sex Education to come back. I can't wait for the next 10 episodes of Generation, or 16, or I can't remember if it's 8 or 16 episodes of Generation Part 2. And anyone who knows me knows that I am forever a Dawson's Creek diehard. Although I'm shifting from Team Dawson to Team Pacey in my adult, you know, later years, but I digress.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Controversial.
I feel a little guilty because I've always been a big James Vanderbeek fan, which we can go back and touch on that. But, whatever happened to those characters on Pose? I know we're just extending the interview here, but do you ever think about where they are now?
I will say, not so much James's character, if I'm being honest, but I do think quite a bit about Evan Peters' character, Stan. I think partly because everyone has had that, well, I shouldn't say everyone, but I think a lot of people have had that ex that seems to like always pop back up at the worst times in your life. And so I think about that character a lot because I'm like, you know, what would that look like for poor Angel, you know, to like have this person come back again? And he was kind of a mess, but yeah, I think about him sometimes, you know, I hope he's well.
Well, on that note, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us and for the great interview.
Thank you.
Pose begins its third and final season Sunday with back-to-back episodes at 10 p.m. on FX.
Number 5.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics' Corner. This week's major new launches include The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, Apple's Mosquito Coast, The Girlfriend Experience on Stars, and you just heard our terrific interview with Stephen Canals, the final season of Pose. Dan, what you got this week?
Lots and lots of stuff. The fourth season of Handmaid's Tale premiered on Wednesday on Hulu, but it was embargoed, so couldn't talk about it last week. It's Handmaid's Tale-y. And I think everyone at this point kind of knows where they are on Handmaid's Tale. And so I'm not going to tell you that you desperately need to tune in. I can tell you that if you've been waiting for the show to get to certain things, I've seen the first 8 episodes of this season, and some of the things that you've been waiting for really do happen in the second half of the season. That's either a spoiler or it isn't. But what I can also say is that if you've been frustrated by the show's kind of scatterbrained approach to introducing different situations and then kind of backing out of those situations in an episode or two to do a full reset that the show didn't need rather than attempting to live in any worlds, it definitely does those things again. And the first 3 episodes are already out and you can already see it. The first 2 episodes are set in at a farmhouse, part of the resistance, introduce a couple new characters. You might be thinking, let's spend 5 or 6 episodes in this world. And they don't. And that, unfortunately, is a problem with what the show does these days, is that it doesn't have enough commitment to, I don't know, to wanting to explore the pieces of its world. And a lot of the things that the show does that are most frustrating are on display in these episodes. The third episode is borderline sadistic in its nonstop 63 minutes of character abuse. It is an exhausting episode to watch, and not in a way that I found the least bit fulfilling, in a way that I found was a lot like previous torture-heavy episodes of Handmaid's Tale. And unfortunately, that episode happened to be Elizabeth Moss's debut as a director, and I don't blame her because there was obviously a script that was 63 minutes worth of torture, and she just gave him what the script asked for. Somebody probably could have looked at those 63 minutes, seriously, 63 minutes, and said, yeah, okay, let's do 50. That's a longer than normal episode. No one did that. And unfortunately, when you're a show that's won Emmys and basically been a brand defying show, you can get away with things like that. But a lot of the things that I love about the show, I still love about the show. I still think you can't praise Elizabeth Moss highly enough. I think that is one of the great TV performances really of all time. And she continues to be spectacular, and the show continues to get good value out of, I don't know, deciding that maybe June isn't such a good person as anyone who's been watching the show has known. So, but it's a lot. And so, you know, again, I can tell you that the show does get some interesting places by the 6th and 7th and 8th episodes. And so if you want to check back in, then all you need to know is that before then people have been tortured and subjugated and stuff. And you don't necessarily need to know the plot that led you up to them. It's okay. Premiering on Friday is The Mosquito Coast on Apple TV Plus. And I loved the Paul Theroux novel and the Peter Weir movie when I was younger. I think they are great and quirky and esoteric stories that have a main character, Ali Fox, who was played by Harrison Ford in the movie, who is a prototype for the 21st century prestige TV archetype, you know, the family man who thinks he's doing the right thing for the good of his family, but goes deeper and darker into whatever. I don't think you can have a Walter White or a Marty Bird from Ozark without Ali Fox. Unfortunately, what the series does is it takes the things that are most distinctive about the character and the situation, and it doesn't even get up to the events of the book. And it's not really and truly a prequel, because I think it changes enough things about the characters and the situation that the actual situation of the book and the movie won't make any sense anymore. I think there's a lot of good acting here. So you have Justin Theroux, who is Paul Theroux's nephew, who plays the main character. He's very, very good, because I think he's a good actor. You have Melissa George, who I think is an amazingly underrated actor. She makes interesting choices and she gives interesting performances. I think she is terrific in the role that Helen Mirren played in the movie. A youngish Helen Mirren, just as we all were back in 1986. Youngish. or younger than we are now. And the kids are pretty good also. I mean, you know, there's no River Phoenix among the young actors in the cast, but, you know, I rewatched the movie a couple weeks ago, and A, it's a great movie, and boy, we lost a lot when we lost River Phoenix as young as we did. So I think if you can distance yourself from the property and just take it as a kind of by-the-numbers prestige cable drama, it's okay. I just happen to personally think that it deserves to be better than that. And so that's where my disappointment comes in. Let's see, what else we got this weekend? On Sunday, we've got the premiere of the third season of The Girlfriend Experience on Starz, which I consider to be one of the oddest ongoing TV franchises there is, because who would have thought you would have gotten three seasons of anthology TV out of that movie that Steven Soderbergh did with Sasha Grey that no one particularly remembers? Each season of Girlfriend Experience takes a different look at sex work or characters involved in sex work. And this year's main character is played by Julia Tellis, who people will know as Sasha from Bunheads. And if you know her from Sasha as Bunheads on Bunheads, you will be very, very, very taken aback by some of the things that Sasha from Bunheads is saying on Girlfriend Experience. She's got a potty mouth, that Sasha from Bunheads now. I continue to find the show sort of hit and miss. I like the exploration of eroticism and desire that the franchise is doing. And I like that they're entrusting different seasons to different people to do these things. And that's a really interesting approach to TV. Whether or not I find any of them completely satisfying is something else. But I think that the main character and the main performance are interesting. And I think that there are interesting things here. And Anya Marquardt is the new writer and director, and she definitely has a perspective. I think the introspective babbling about desire and neurology and other strange things that the show's doing doesn't really work entirely, but still worth checking out if you're curious. And finally, you just heard our great interview with Stephen Canals about Pose. I was mixed, honestly, on the four episodes I've seen of the third season. It feels messy, and it feels like there really were impacts via COVID that you can unfortunately tell. And that's just an unfortunate thing, because, you know, the show deserved to go out on the most perfect of conditions, as opposed to in a more hit and miss scattershot form. I still, you know, Billy Porter continues to be wonderful. MJ Rodriguez continues to be wonderful. The number of scenes that Dominique Jackson steals by saying utterly ridiculous, wonderful things that only Elektra could say, continue to just be a total hoot. So this is a show that is a special and important show. I wish I felt like it was going out at absolute peak condition, but still, it's a show worth checking out. And if you haven't watched the first two seasons, they're all on Hulu.
FX on Hulu, yeah.
FX on Hulu. Leslie, I've heard rumors that you aren't a critic, but do you have anything you want to say about this? Because you've actually made it through the entire season. I just simply was not able to.
I still like the final season. I didn't love it as much as I love season one. And I didn't think season two was as good as season one. I will say that, you know, seven episodes was not enough. I personally would have loved to have seen 10 episodes, because there are developments and things that are completely skipped over that I would have loved to have seen these characters do and the writers do. But that said, I'm very much, you just heard me gush all over Stephen Canals and how much I love this show. And it's an important one, and it's one that I feel like the finale, I think, you know, is probably a little predictable once you've seen half of the season, but it kind of finds its ways to subvert expectations. Billy Porter is fantastic, as you said. MJ Rodriguez remains my absolute favorite part of this show. You know, she brings so much heart to Pose, and I will never not identify with characters like that and love characters like that. But yeah, it's, you know, It definitely feels rushed at times because you've got 7 episodes and they're a little longer than usual, much to your chagrin, Dan. Finale is supersized. I think it'll probably be a 2-hour runtime, but you know, I still think it would have benefited from more time to kind of fill in the blanks for some of these characters because, you know, it makes their journeys a little feel slightly less earned. But that's my 2 cents. And you can disagree because I'm not a critic. There you go. But I still love it. That's it. And the soundtrack remains A+, as it does every season. Well, that feels like a good place to wrap things up for this week. Thanks for listening to TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. We'll be back next week when we'll be joined by Meredith Scardino of Peacock's Girls 5 Eva.
Be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. It helps spread the word of mouth, moves us up search engines and whatnot.
And we read those reviews too. So if you've got comments and things you'd like to see on the show or things that we're doing that annoy the crap out of you, we'll read those.
Stop review pandering. But also, if you have those various comments and concerns, you can always come say hi to us on Twitter. We're always happy to hear from you. And if you have questions for future mailbag segments, or as we did this week, just kind of inserting a question into a topic we wanted to do anyway, we are always happy to hear them. You can email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.
Hey, Drew Scott here, and I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.